Hello, friends. What's going on, everybody? Been a while. We have a new episode for you. I wanted to come on here, say a couple things before we start this episode. First, business stuff. I have just started the Master Your Mind course. It's a 8-week course that is basically education. You learn how to process emotions and feelings and sensations and differentiate between all of them, understand what trauma is, understand how to find a therapist, relationship tools. It's a pretty cool little course. Well, it's not really little. It's actually quite intense. It's awesome. I'm really excited about it. So far, so good. If you are interested in being in the next round of the Master Your Mind course, hit me up, social media, through the podcast website, through my website, findingstrength.com, finding-strength.com. Had a couple people sign up from the podcast listeners from the last time I talked about this, so I thought I'd say it again. If you're interested, hit me up. Would love to work with you. Also, second item, this podcast contains explicit material, not for kids. We get into some pretty heavy stuff on this podcast. It is, I would venture to say, one of the most controversial yet. It's a heavy subject. We talk about sexually explicit subjects. We talk about interviews with children. We talk about the LDS faith specifically, Mormon faith specifically. And I know a lot of our audience are members of the LDS faith, and our friends and family are members of the LDS faith. Bethany and I are no longer members of the LDS faith. However, we were our entire childhood. We talk about that in this episode. It's not easy to talk about. This was actually pretty difficult to record, difficult to think about. Definitely quite activating for us as we went through it. But Sam he's doing the work, man. He's got a great cause. Sam Young, if you don't know who he is, you will after this episode. I say that in the beginning. He started an organization. First was called Protect LDS Children. Now it's called Protect Every Child. Great website, a lot of information, a lot of stories, a lot of ways to connect to the world. It's definitely a subject that needs to be talked about. So as you go through listening to this episode, take a step back. Begin to question things that you thought were supposed to be, right? That's shame in and of itself. The idea of shame is it's this emotional thing that we feel that keeps us from changing. That's the design of shame, to keep things going the same way they were before. When we ask hard questions, when we talk about difficult subjects, when we begin to question powerful organizations, powerful traditions, that ruffles feathers, to say the least. And this episode will likely ruffle some feathers. If we offend you, I apologize in advance. If you feel hurt or scared or mad or angry, take those feelings and work with them. Use them to learn. Use them to understand, because the main message that we are trying to get through with this episode of the Finding Strength podcast is there is stuff going on behind closed doors that we largely ignore, that we can no longer ignore because it hurts children. It hurts adults. And I think this is an episode that needed to come out. So I'm excited. And if you guys have feedback or you want to talk to us about it, email me, matt@finding-strength.com. I'd be more than happy to have a conversation with you. And again, if you want to work with me, that too, that's always an option. So without further ado, here we go. Season 4, Episode 2 of the Finding Strength podcast with Sam Young. Enjoy.
Well, welcome back, Finding Strength Podcast. Sitting here with Bethany.
It's weird that I can see myself. That's not normal.
I'm so used to Zoom. It doesn't even faze me. We're doing something a little different this week, team. Our audio probably won't be as high quality as we usually get, but that's fine because we have a super rad guest this week. Some of you may be familiar with Sam Young. Others might not. After this, you will be. Sam, super excited to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much, sir. Thank you. It's going to go in and out too, guys.
We're going to reboot again.
You're fine. On our end, it'll keep recording because I'm recording on my computer. So we'll just keep talking. It'll go in and out.
So if me and Matt just start talking about nothing, it's because we're waiting for Sam's computer to catch up.
Not a big deal. Because Sam's actually in
Mexico
in Cozumel.
Oh, Cozumel.
That's where you were, right?
No, we were Cancun.
Cozumel is the island right off Cancun.
Next to it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But how was Cancun?
Good.
Was it fun?
Yes.
Yeah, we haven't really touched base since then.
I know,
crazy. And Sam's back.
There we go.
All right.
So Sam, where are you from? I guess you're in Mexico right now, but where do you live?
I'm originally from Layton, Utah. I was raised there. I lived there until I graduated from Brigham Young University and then moved to Houston, Texas.
Okay, so you've been in Houston for quite a while.
Since 1976.
Yep, that is quite a while.
And you guys were born, right?
Yep, I was 80.
Yep, I'm 83. Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Been a minute, right? Yep.
How many kids do you have?
Darn.
Oh, can you not hear me? There's a little lag right now. Well,
slow.
It doesn't look like it's lagging. You just can't hear me.
That's what happens. That's how Zoom works. I do Zoom calls all day and I get these
random.
Oh man, it is so irritating. In and out and
well,
in
we
and out.
Can tell a little of what we know about Sam too when it's lagging.
For sure. And he'll catch up.
So how we know Sam, how I do, is from the ex-Mormon community. So those who don't know what that is, it's just a community of people who have left the Mormon religion and we're looking for camaraderie, right? Yeah,
for sure.
So it's
like-minded people.
On Facebook, it's one way and there's just different ways.
Yep. And I think we got Sam back. Do we have you back, sir? Nope, we don't.
I can kind of hear him trying to kick in. Mm. So Sam, what is he? Oh, there he is.
You're back.
Hi. You there?
Okay, I do have another option. Do you want to try another option so you can hear us better?
Sure. Okay. Well, I can hear you and then I can hear you for a good bit and then it goes out.
That's in and out. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut off our video and see if that makes it a little better.
Okay.
So we're going to go dark.
You want me to go dark?
We'll see if just us going dark makes a difference because then it's not as much bandwidth going through. And if you to go dark, and we'll just go just audio, which is fine too.
Okay.
Okay, so far so good. So Bethany was just explaining the way that we kind of all have come to know each other is through the kind of ex-Mormon, past Mormon community and you're kind of a figure in the LDS faith community, especially the ex-LDS faith community, because you've done a lot of work to help a lot of people. And maybe you can kind of tell your story a little bit of how that all came about.
Okay. You ready for it?
Ready. Yeah. Bring it.
And feel free to stop me at any point if you've got questions. Okay. So my faith transition actually started in 2014. And June 2014, I found some stuff out that I had no idea existed that challenged the traditional story that I've been told about the founding of the church. And so I jumped into the rabbit hole. I was obsessed. I was reading all kinds of material, watching podcasts for 4, 5, 6 hours every day through the night. It was consuming a lot of time. It took me about 5 months, I realized that what I had been taught my entire life was not true. And talk about traumatic. That was a gut punch to the stomach, a kick in the stomach. It's like a horse that kicked me in the side. It was not easy. It took a long while for that to go through the stages of grief with regards to that. And I can tell you several things that happened after that. So this was November 2014. I decided, okay, even though this stuff is not true, I've been lied to and deceived my entire life. My free agency was stolen from me. Okay, fine. But my family's in, my wife's in, my community, my friends are here. The community I built for 40 years. It's my life. I'm going to stay in the church. But I was pretty open with what I thought and what I believed. I knew that it was a super painful process to me. And back in 2014, there were a lot of people leaving the church, but most people didn't know folks were leaving the church. Most people didn't know people that had left the church. And so you kind of felt alone. I went to talk to my bishop, and he basically said, Satan is getting into your mind. Be careful, or you're going to be succumbing to temptations. Go read all the conference talks. And Sam, you're the only one questioning anything. And I'm thinking in my mind, no, I know other people are. In fact, there's another former bishop in our ward that I just met with the week before, because I was sensing that he was questioning. Well, he was, and he was completely out beliefs wise. But I'm thinking, okay, the bishop, my bishop, doesn't realize what's the undercurrent that is at some point in time going to come to light. And I went to talk to him, not about my doubts, but because I'd kind of resolved them at that point. It was, look, our friends are in trauma. Our friends are questioning, and there's no place to discuss these issues. We need to provide some place to provide those issues. Well, he poo-pooed me. And so a while later, I got in touch with the state president and started talking with him about the same thing. We talked for 2 years about establishing some place where members who were questioning could talk about the issues in the church. Well, after 2 years, he said, no, we're not going to do anything. but about 3 or 4 months after we started talking, I decided to move ahead, and I started what I called the Talkeria, which I just went to a little hot dog restaurant and said, look, I'm going to be here starting at 7 o'clock until 10 o'clock when the place closes. Feel free to, if there's any issues about the Mormon church you would like to talk about, this is a safe place to do it. Over the course of the next 2 years, hundreds of people came to the Talkeria. And part of the reason I started the Talkeria, one was I needed someplace to talk about these things.
Oh, yeah. When you're going through it, you need to like vent, you need to like word vomit everything that's coming. Like, and yep, not everyone is safe to do that to, because yep, people start to shun you. And if you're in the church, you can be kicked out. And there's just, so I think that's a awesome thing that you did, because we felt that need to just talk.
Yeah. Well, you as therapists know that talking, there's something magical about talking, something healing about being able to talk out your issues.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
So it was helpful to me, but I also was doing it not just for me. I did have that selfish motive though, but it was to help others that were going through the same gut-wrenching thing I was. And I took the attitude that whatever path you decided to follow, we support. Now, that time I was an active member of the church, a former bishop that still carries weight and respect, even in a doubting ex-Mormon community. But we were supporting anybody that wanted to stay in church. And so we had several people come that were looking for ways to stay in the church. Well, okay, I get that. I'm staying in the church. And so you got a good example here. If you've left the church, great. We had people come that had left the church 20 years ago that still wanted to talk about it. We had gay and lesbian people come that, you know, obviously had issues they want to discuss and look for the support and compassion and love that you felt in these meetings. Okay, so that lasted for about 2 years. I continued to do that for a while after I started Protect LDS Children. So here's what happened with regards to Protect LDS Children, why that movement was started. Since I was open about my journey, about my belief, my faith, people that had questions would reach out to me. I had a man that I had home taught for 20 years. And he came to me one day and he said, Sam, I think I misspoke. I had been his home teacher for 10 years. He had never come to church once during those 10 years. And I'd never asked him why he didn't come. I was just hoping he would.
Sam, real quick, can you explain what home teaching is for the non-LDS
listeners?
Congregation, pun intended.
Oh. Okay, so it used to be in the Mormon church, but they've changed this now. They had a program called home teaching, where they assigned to the men a certain number of families. That is your responsibility to watch over them, to visit them once a month. And if there were any needs, like a blessing, or they needed a job reference, or they needed... Danny, there are just various things that you were looking out for them. So you visited them once a month.
Yeah, you kind of get like assigned a family, and you're kind of in charge of making sure that they maintain their status in the church or reinvigorate their desire to attend, as well as help them out with, you know, vocational stuff, relational stuff, things like that. But really, so anyway, this guy, you become friends with him.
Yeah. And so one day he said, Sam, I think it's about time that I tell you why I don't go to church. So I go over to his house and we go out on his patio and he brings out a cup of coffee, asked me if I would want one. And I said, well, no. I knew he smoked. I didn't know he drank coffee. He then said, this is why I don't go to church. Several years ago, his kids are basically the age of some of my kids. And he said they came back to church, he and his wife, because they wanted their children to be raised in the church and be taught the church Christian values. And they were doing this for a certain length of time, I would guess a few months. And one day, one of his sons, 14-year-old, came in and said, Dad, the bishop has asked to meet with him. And he was nervous about that. He didn't know about the regular every 6 month interviews that the bishops are supposed to do. Well, his dad, my friend, told him that, don't worry about it. I'll come out and sit on the couch. If there's any problem at all, I'll be right there. Well, his son goes in for the interview. A few minutes later, he comes out. He is obviously extremely distressed. And he tells his dad, Dad, the bishop just asked me if I masturbate and if I have sex with other boys.
Oh my gosh.
The dad was incensed those questions would be asked of his son. So he stood up, walked in, leaned over the bishop's desk and told the bishop, if you ever ask my son a question like that again, either one of my sons, I will beat you to a pulp. Yeah. When he told me this, I'm sitting there thinking, wow, this guy. So first of all, this is an intimidating guy, an ex-police officer. He served in Vietnam, in Cambodia and Laos, without name, dog tags, without a uniform. He was behind the enemy lines. He just is an imposing kind of guy. So when I was first assigned as his home teacher, I thought, oh man, yeah. He intimidates me, but we became great friends. But you can just picture this imposing guy leaning across the desk and threatening the bishop because of the questions, the sexual questions that he had just posed to his child. I then put on Facebook. Now remember, I was a former bishop. Yeah. So here's a bishop asking these questions.
So you've asked those questions before.
I have never, ever asked a child if they masturbate.
Are you supposed to? So this is, I think, where it gets kind of tricky. Is that in like a handbook or some sort to ask that?
No.
As a not. Being a member of the church, I was asked that as a child.
Yeah, it's not. Although there have been many leaders who've been instructed. I think that question comes, I think all the sexual questions come from a couple sources. Number one, tradition, where you were asked those questions when you were a kid. You now become a bishop 20 years later, and you think, well, we're supposed to do that. Okay, it's just normal. Part of the culture. Well, I wasn't asked those questions, so it wasn't in my head to be asking that. And then the other, it comes directly from general authorities, regional authorities. I've had bishops, stake presidents tell me that the general authority over them said, you have got to ask this question if the kids masturbate, and probe with other questions if you find out they made out, if they had, if somebody touched a boob, if somebody touched a penis. No, you need to ask really detailed questions then. That is what some general authorities have taught the state presidents and bishops they work with. I was never taught that. So when I found this out.
Is that in the handbook, Sam? Do you know?
No, it's not. No. Wow. It's not.
So it's not necessary, really.
And it's more word of mouth tradition, kind of like you get to, some of you do, some of you don't.
It's tradition and direction from general authorities that is not always put in writing. I have seen a letter from a regional authority or general authority to a group of state presidents and mission presidents that met in Bountiful, where it said, ask specific detailed sexual questions. But that's not in a manual. But that was instructions that was given at a conference. So the instructions have been given, but they're not, you won't find them in writing.
Of course you won't, because then that would make things wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Crazy.
But so you asked, did I ever ask a kid, do you masturbate? Well, now I'm aware of the question, but back when this guy's asking this, and when I started doing the next things that I'll tell you about, I was thinking, why in the world would that question ever have come into my mind? Who has that question come into their mind? A 12-year-old girl, 13-year-old girl, 16-year-old girl sitting across the desk, who has it into their mind? I wonder if she puts her fingers between her legs and masturbates. Who thinks of that? That is perverted, okay?
It is. Yes, it is.
It is.
Okay, here I go. That's goddamn perverted. Okay. So after he told me this,
pardon me, interject for a second.
Absolutely.
As a boy, I was asked those questions by my ecclesiastical leaders regularly.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most uncomfortable situations I'd ever been put into as a child. And the amount of shame that I felt in those situations was excruciating. And it's something to this day that I'm still working through. Like I'm a freaking trauma therapist, man. And I'm working on my own trauma. You want to know what some of the biggest stuff is? Sexual messages that were sent to me repeatedly over and over and over as a child of what is and is not okay. That gets hardwired into your brain. The brain matter grows around these narratives that are created. Especially the strong ones about and belief systems about yourself, where if you're doing this normal, natural thing and you believe that it's bad to do, you now have created this existential conflict between biology and, well, basically morality, but not really morality, self-imposed ethical standards that are not normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this gigantic crisis that every single human child is thrust into unwittingly, unwillingly, repeatedly throughout their entire adolescence. And I still struggle with it today.
You know,
38 years old.
It's funny to me. My husband Kevin says that he got asked that question as a teenager, and he said that he didn't even know what that word meant when they asked him.
Yes.
And he's like, I remember the bishop asking me, and I was like, I don't even understand. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know what that is. So I'm like, oh, good. So now we have sex ed from a bishop. That's awesome for some young teenagers, adolescents.
And not only is it just sex ed, it's sex ed with shame spooned, heaped upon you along with it.
Right. Right.
So this is 2016. Is that right? No, 2017. March, my friend tells me this. I go to Facebook and I pose a question. I don't think I did it openly, but I think I did on some closed Facebook groups, ex-Mormon Facebook groups, asking, like Mormon Stories podcast community, and asked the question, was anybody asked this question? Anybody else asked this question besides this kid? I was flooded with stories, and they were horror stories. Back then, I didn't know what caused all this trauma.
Yeah.
Now, I have trauma from it, too. I was never asked the question, but I knew masturbation was wrong. Well, of course, I masturbated as a kid, but I thought I was the only one that masturbated, and I was the only one that couldn't quit. But at least my bishop wasn't putting the shame. I wasn't talking to the bishop about it, so I was spared that gigantic shame. But I didn't think it was common out there for people to masturbate, nor for them to be asked these questions. Well, all these stories, and they were horrendous stories that result into self-loathing, where the kids hated themselves. Once you start hating yourself as a kid, well, that can move into lots of other areas where you give up on school, you start getting involved in drugs, you start getting involved in a whole bunch of sex, or you completely withdraw from sex completely. These are adults telling their stories that this sexual shame was carried with them right into their marriage, where sex in marriage is a super hard thing and difficult and filled with shame. Suicide ideation, extremely common. Attempting suicide, common. Probably 30% of the stories that have been shared with me, suicide was attempted. And stories of kids completing suicide. All this over the horrendous intrusion, totally unprofessional, totally wrong, into children's lives by bishops asking sexual questions. So now I know it's out there all over the place. I started collecting stories. So that's March, April, May. So about 3 months. And finally, I got up the guts to approach one of my daughters who is living with me and my wife, to ask her, and she was maybe 27 at the time, ask her. And I'd never said the word masturbation to my daughters ever. I'd never said it in my house. Now it's a very common word that's said in my house after all this journey. But I asked her, sweetie, were you ever asked as a kid if you masturbated? Yes, Dad. When I was 12, I didn't know what it was. I asked my friends. They didn't know what it was. Didn't know what it was at age 12.
How in the hell can we, does this practice continue? These children are introduced. The thing for me is it's the unwitting, unknowing part that is so unbelievably shocking and traumatic. My specialization as a trauma therapist is childhood sexual abuse, Sam. That's what I do. I work with women, especially who have childhood sexual abuse. The most traumatic thing that can happen to a human being is an unknown sexual experience. That's it. It's number one on the list. That sticks.
The number one trauma.
That sticks with you longer and harder. It is more confusing, more shocking, more disrupting than nearly any other type of trauma because of its direct link to sex, and sex is direct link to love. So now what we are creating is not just a crisis of sexual nature. We are creating an existential crisis of relationships and love and how to relate to another. And that's the translation that is happening in these interviews that is so unbelievably profound for these young children. And it is not just hard to undo. It is excruciatingly difficult to undo, and it takes years for people to undo sexual trauma. Now, some people might think, well, getting asked a question in an interview is not considered sexual trauma. Unfortunately, they'd be wrong, because it is.
Yeah. And it gets compounded when you're asked, okay, so I asked my daughter, she said she didn't know what it was. Her friends didn't know what it was, so she Googled it. Well, guess what you find when you Google masturbation? Well, you find out, she said, Dad, I found out what it was. Mm-hmm. I found out how to do it. I was introduced to pornography by searching for masturbation.
And I asked her a simple question. That's not
yes. Sexual.
Right. But the thing is there's so much shame heaped on top of this subject. These children believe they can't go to their parents and talk about it because it's sinful and wrong, and they'll get in trouble if they do.
Yeah.
So where did they go?
Here, and I ask that question.
Yeah. They do exactly what your daughter did.
That's what any kid would do.
Yeah.
That's what I would do.
Yeah. Anyway, continue, please.
I ask her, why didn't you come talk to me about this, honey? Because I asked her also, were you only asked it once? She says, no, all the time, Dad, the whole time I was in the young women. So for 6 years, she's being asked that question. Then I asked, did you lie about it? Did you ever lie about it? She says, oh, Dad. Oh yeah, Dad. Just like all the other kids.
Yep.
Then why didn't you come talk to me or mom about this? I mean, it's gotta be super uncomfortable to it in the first place, but her answer stunned me. She said, Dad, you knew I was having those interviews. I assumed you and mom were totally okay with the questions that were being asked. I thought you knew what was happening.
And so it's a betrayal from the parents too.
That are unknowing.
Guilt by association.
Yeah.
You're complicit in asking these questions in the mind of a child. Mom and dad know that I'm being put in these uncomfortable situations and they're okay with it. The crisis that happens cognitively for these little kids, and we're talking little kids, 12 years old, the capacity of a 12-year-old child to comprehend something this complex is not even there. It's not even this. You end up blaming yourself. You have to. That's just what we do as children. There's no, you don't have the capacity to understand the nuance of parents and adults and actual life. And the crisis that's there for these kids is so unbelievably formidable that they just can't shake it. And who are we supposed to, we're supposed to be there for our kids, and they can't go to us when we're having these questions because of the shame. It's a perfect storm, and you know better than anybody.
Yeah, and I mean, asking about masturbation, that's a killer in and of itself. There are kids that have died by suicide. There are many kids that have attempted suicide over masturbation. Okay, now, it gets even worse. I mean, it's hard to get worse than that, but it is, because the bishops can also do things, continue to have interviews, month after month, year after year, where the kid can't quit masturbating. Well, that's super common. So the shame just builds and builds and builds. If you happen to have made out with your girlfriend or your boyfriend, then the questions go to, did you touch her? Did he touch you? Where did he touch you? Show me where he touched you. What color were your underwear? Did you make love? Did you have sex? Describe your sexual position. Now talk about getting into shame.
Were you aroused? How aroused?
Yes.
What? Yep.
In the trauma
world. Did you reach an orgasm?
Yep. I got asked all those questions.
In the trauma world.
I'm sorry about that.
We call this, it's called secondary wounding. There's actually a term for it, right? So the example that I always give is secondary wounding. Best example of secondary wounding is, imagine that I get into a car accident and one of my children gets hurt. It's me driving, and my wife shows up and she says, how could you do this to my children? There's two traumas there, and they don't just compound on each other. There's this exponential growth in the traumatic effect on that primitive part of the brain when the secondary wounding comes in. Another metaphor for this is, imagine that you have a wound on your body, a physical wound on your body, and someone comes up to it and this open wound and comes and puts their finger in it or punches it. The secondary wound is actually more traumatic than the first.
Mm.
And that's the other compounding problem with a lot of these interviews with these untrained, unskilled people. It's scary.
So once I heard all these horrendous things were going, actually once I found out that it happened to my child, let's see, 8 to 12 years beforehand. And I actually found out it happened to four of my children, I've got six daughters. It happened to four out of my six daughters that were asking stupid, idiotic, inappropriate questions behind closed doors. That lit a fire in me. This has to change. And I was at the same time reading all these stories that I was being sent. It has to change, and it's a no-brainer, right? It's a no-brainer. This is a good church. These are good people. As soon as you talk to people about it, they'll realize, oh no, we don't want that being asked our kids. That is super dangerous and wrong. Well, I found out I ran into kind of a brick wall because of the culture of the church of you all hail to the prophet, seek heil to the prophet. Whatever he says, whatever comes from Salt Lake City, we do that. We never object to anything. Well, I ran into that and was frankly surprised. I shouldn't have been, but I was. Started talking to my stake president, my bishop, that we needed to change this. I got no interest in that. So I started writing blogs about it. I wrote blog after blog after blog about it. And that what's happening here is people are starting to pay attention. So people started to pay attention. Then I started a petition. Let's do a petition and present that to the church. So I did a lot of things to promote the petition. We ended up getting, I can't remember, like 60,000 signatures on the petition. And then how do you present it? At the end of the petition, this is the end of 2017. People are reaching out to me, sharing stories with me, but there's no place for the stories to be shared with everybody. So I started the website Protect LDS Children, where people could share their stories anonymously or not anonymously, or they would give me their name and email address, but I wouldn't share it unless they wanted me to share their name. And some did, most didn't. And so these stories started to come. There are over 1,000 stories, and I probably have another 100 that I need to put up on the website because people still are sharing stories. It's cathartic, not just to speak about it, but to write about it. These stories, I had had many people tell me, Sam, you know what? I can read 10 of those stories and then I want to go throw up because yeah, they are so horrendous what we've done to our children. So what are we going to do with the stories and the petition? I decided, you know, let's do a march. That'll get attention. That'll raise this awareness even further, because fortunately the awareness has started to expand. Both of you mentioned that you resigned as a result of what was going on here. So somehow the awareness reached you. It reached a ton of people. So we did a march in Salt Lake City. 1,000 people show, which I was blown away by. 1,000. It was such a fun event. Were either one of you there?
No,
we watched. Okay. Yeah, I remember.
You did. Okay.
Yeah. It was all over the place. It was on the news. Yeah.
Yeah. The news stations, the TV stations came out and marched with us and interviewed people as we went up the hill. So we marched from City Hall up to the church office building, and there I printed 15 books of the stories. We presented, which every one of the books had a name of an apostle on it, a name of the apostle or first president. So those were the books were for. And we also printed out the petitions, which had 3,000 or 4,000 stories in them too. So we presented thousands of stories to the church. And then I went back home to Houston, and this was March 30th, 2017, and thought, okay, we've accomplished a good work. There are tons of people that are now familiar with this, and hopefully they're protecting their children. But the church really needs to change their policy. And believe it or not, the church actually did a minor change to their policy, which was very helpful, the day before the march. Now, I was asked, are you going to not march because the church has made a change. Well, you know, I would have marched no matter what, because all the motion was in place. But if they had made the change that we really need to eliminate, we were after no one-on-one interviews. That's dangerous, yeah. Right there. And no sexually explicit questions, no sex questions. If they had changed those two, we would have had a march in celebration, yeah, of what, sure, the church had done. But the change was minor but significant. It didn't eliminate either one. But what they did is they said, look, if the kid wants somebody else in the room, the kid can ask for somebody else to be in the room. Okay, fine. Fortunately, the newspapers got it wrong. All the newspapers announced, church now allows a second person interviews. Well, good. That sounds a good message, that it was okay to do that, as opposed to parents, it's none of your say. It is the kids, period. Let the kid protect themselves.
Right. Kid's going to, yeah, really speak up like that at 12 years old?
Nobody is going to. No. And at any age, you don't want to go in there and have somebody ask you about. Oh, you're not going
to tell shit to your bishop with your mom sitting right next to you. No.
With your mom sitting there, could you please describe the sexual positions you and your boyfriend engaged in?
Right?
No kid wants that if they already know those are questions are coming. So anyway, the next thing we did was in June, we did a button day where we asked supporters to wear buttons to church of Protect the Children. It's kind of interesting. I went to Natasha Helfer's excommunication trial vigil the other day, and two people came up to me and said, Sam, I just want to let you know, I wore a button on that Sunday to church, which I thought was kind of cool. But nothing is happening. And so I decided to take a page out of some other prominent folks that had worked, been able to cause some great change. And that is, I decided to do a hunger strike. So end of July and during most of August, I did a hunger strike, a 23-day hunger strike, no food at all. I lost 35 pounds. But that wasn't the purpose of it. The purpose of it was to raise the awareness. A ton of press coverage we received there. We did a podcast every night, Facebook Live podcast from Temple Square, over 500,000 views, which is amazing. Wow. On that little Facebook thing. And it really was such a wonderful thing to stand there and allow people to come and talk about their stories. Every night we invited a general authority, one of the apostles, to come. I had a little chair. We invited them, come down and meet the people that need to be ministered to, that have been harmed by their upbringing in the church. And of course, we never got any response practices to that.
No,
yeah.
No. They don't leave Temple Square. Come on.
Yeah. But it was very effective for, I guess, highlighting that. Well, okay, I'm just going to say this. The apostles don't give a damn about the members of the church. They give a damn about their power and their authority and how they call it the good name of the church, protect the good name of the church. Well, if you're serious about protecting the good name of the church, you're not serious about that. You're serious about protecting your power and not allowing it to be challenged. But that's why they don't show up to minister to the people that their policies have hurt. And even if it wasn't there, even if they don't believe it was their policies, these are hurting people. Like Matt, you said, it takes forever to work through this trauma. Right. These are people that are still trying to work through it. And just to have somebody and a whole bunch of other people stand up and say, what happened to you was wrong. It wasn't your fault. We're standing up to speak up for on your behalf and for all the children that are still in the church. Anyway, after the hunger strike, I felt like, okay, that was a super wonderful experience. Touched many people. So many people reached out that this was a healing experience. And by the way, part of that, we held a meeting one night as opposed to doing the Facebook Live. We did a Facebook Live where we rented a place and 300 people showed up. This is the night I was invited, inviting President Nelson to come. And we had a service. It was a Sunday. And I tell you, it was, we had many people say that was the most spiritual meeting I've ever been to. We had, I collected a list of about 60 former bishops that wanted to publicly apologize for the harm that has been done to the children of the church through the interview practices. I was one of those on the list, of course, and we wrote an apology, and that apology was read that night. And you know, it was meaningful to a whole bunch of people. That's to hear these really cool. Hear these former bishops apologize in public to the world for what we had done.
Incredible.
So a lot of great things. So after that was all over, I felt like, okay, I'm feeling really good. We've done some great work. I'm ready to go home, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but I think I'm kind of done for a while with this. The next week, within days, I received a letter calling me to my court of excommunication. So, okay, so there, I've just told you a whole bunch of stuff. Questions, comments, where do you want me to go next?
So, no, I remember this so much because, like what you're saying, 2014, it's crazy because that's when we were beginning our exit of sorts. Ours was June of 2014, and it took us about a year and a half to really say we're done, because it's hard. It's a part of you. It's a part of your childhood. Yeah. It's a part of your family. You feel like you're hurting your family, which you are in some aspects.
It's woven into your belief system.
Oh, we talk all the time about our Mormon brain all the time, because there's things I have to, I'll immediately have a reaction to something, whether it's my children or a friend or anybody. And I'm like, no. That's my Mormon brain. It's fine. Think logically and not so abrasive so quickly. But so, yeah, we were going through that at the same time. So I think that's why everything you said resonated so much. And I had my own experience that I can share later, but it's where I was severely traumatized by a statement. And from all the questions you're asking, and I, at the time, I didn't realize
how. Well, I share it later. You should just share it right now. I'm just kidding. I'm just totally teasing.
I know,
I'm teasing.
Well, no, I guess I can share it. I'm not embarrassed. You know my story, but I'll share my story. So, I was getting married. Kevin and I were getting married. I was 18.
Oh, I do know this story.
And at the time, I did not know how much it affected me, because I was 18. I was a baby.
Now, you got married at 18?
At 18. So Kevin, my husband.
Wow, pretty.
Super young. I was a baby, and he was 20. So I go into the stake president. You have to ask, they ask you all these questions. Of course, Kevin and I have dated for 2.5 years. So we had some mishaps, according to the church. Nothing major, but just things. But I was floored by the questions, by the intensity of the questions, by the specifics of the questions.
It's the probing.
It is so, it's as a teenage, as a person who's trying to be the best they can be and fit in. And I'm trying to go through the temple and to be asked exactly what you're saying. So where did he touch you? How long were you turned on? How turned on? And I'm like, I left sobbing my eyes out. And then he sat and proceeded to tell me that I was so awful for doing anything we did. And that my husband, the man I'm marrying in a week, is not a good priesthood holder and will never be a good husband to me.
Oh, geez.
And he proceeded to tell me also that he, because he's able to do these things with me after he's already gone through the temple, he will probably cheat on me and our marriage will never work.
Oh, cool.
I'm 18 years old. So it was, I came home.
You're a baby.
Sobbing, 18. Bawling. And luckily my sister was there who's older than me, and I told her what happened, and she was like, yep, that exact same thing happened to me. She's like, same stake president, same situation. He said those same things to me. She was like, don't listen to a word he says. You guys are great. You know, helped me a lot. But I also didn't recognize until I left the church, the fact that those sexual questions, what you're saying has so much truth to it, because I was not able to be open sexually, I guess, if that's the right word, with my own husband because of the trauma I experienced as a teenager.
Because all sexual stuff, questions, thinking, all of that is unsafe now.
Yes.
The reason why it's unsafe is because there's so much shame attached to it. So now my brain can't even talk about this stuff without experiencing the chemical flood of shame, which is viscerally designed to prevent you from doing something and remaining, sticking with the same behavior, right? Like you think about the neural pathways that are created when shame, the chemical flood of shame happens. It's reinforcing old neural pathways so that you don't change. That's very interesting, isn't it? Shame is a mechanism to keep people from changing behavior.
And it works. It 100% works.
It's the tale as old as time.
It's the worst.
It's been around for centuries, millennia. This is what every single large scale oppressive organization has ever used to keep people in line. And that's very strong language. And I know we have part of the fear that I have in having this conversation is, you know, we have avid listeners to our, you know, our podcast who are active members of the LDS faith. Mm-hmm. You know, my family, active members of the LDS faith, who I absolutely love and I respect their decision to stay in the church because it works for them. However, there's this massive part of me that feels remiss for not being vocal about some of the things that really motivated me to
leave.
Exit. Yeah, mm-hmm. To leave. And the repeated, systematic sexual abuse of children is still ongoing.
Yeah.
And that's really strong language. And I think it's accurate.
So, and that's my thing is too, because I agree with Matt. I have a lot of family members still in, and I really hope they listen to this podcast, because as much as, you know, stay in the church, stay out of leave the church, whatever, that is not my issue. What I really want to push is the fact that this situation, these interviews with bishops really screwed me up for a while. I do not want to see that happen to my nieces and my nephews that are a part of that church. So even if all it means is that my siblings or my in-laws can take this and say, okay, so, you know, you still love the church. That's fine. Take this out. Take this, like, don't let them go in there. Don't let them be, you know, a part of this situation. Don't let them have these same traumatic experiences. That's what I want out of this more than anything.
Well, and for you, Sam, as like the resident expert, are there practices or, you know, things that people who are still in the church can do to prevent their children from experiencing the trauma of these, of the interviews? Have you found anything that works?
Absolutely. First of all, it is the responsibility of the parent to protect and raise the child. And we know that being interviewed behind closed doors all alone and asked sexual questions, both those are damaging and dangerous things to do. There are pedophiles in our church. There are stories that have been shared with me, all kinds of stories out there, where a bishop or a bishop's counselor or other pedophiles in the ward have gotten access to the child because of these interviews, where the child can be groomed, where barriers are broken down, that we tell our children you shouldn't go behind closed doors. Well, suddenly it's okay. Somebody has priesthood.
Well,
you shouldn't talk about sex. That's crossing a boundary. Well, we completely obliterate that boundary by allowing the discussion of sex. So if the pedophile happens to be the Sunday school president, he knows what these kids are being groomed to, their boundaries being groomed away. And he's smart. He has an eye for the kids that are vulnerable. And anyway, it's just a super dangerous situation. So what can the parent do? Number one, you be the one that makes sure that there are no one-on-one interviews, no sexual questions. Go in with every single interview. I don't care if your kid is 17 years old. Go into that interview with them. Be a support, be an advocate for your child, and make sure no questions are directed on the with regards to the law of chastity. Now, the bishop may tell you, I have to ask the question. I've got to vent that. Fine, tell him, no, you don't have to ask that. That's unacceptable to me as the parent. If you want that question posed to my kids, you ask me. I am the adult here. That's a kid that you're asking. A child that you're asking, you ask me. I'm going to speak for my children with regards to that. So yeah. If you say, Sam, I need to know, we've got a temple trip coming up. Is your 17-year-old obeying the law of chastity?
Yeah.
I like that.
Then you tell him what you want to say.
That makes way more sense. Well, and the thing is there's precedence for that, right? Adults speak for minors all the time. Legally, yeah. That's how it works. Everywhere. Why amongst clergymen is precedence thrown out the window? Doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. So if your child is going to girls camp or scout camp, of course it's not scout camp anymore, but let's say a camp, youth conference, you've got to get a signature from the parent that it's okay to go to that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you don't have to get a signature from the parent or okay or anything from the parent. You're going to take the kid behind closed doors and ask them, how many fingers do you use when you masturbate? Oh, hell no. That should be totally out of their purview. It should be the parent, period, that raises the kid with regards to those issues.
Honestly, they would take those things out, it'd probably be a relief to a lot of these really good bishops who are sure. Good.
Yes, men. It would.
They don't want to ask these questions.
There's a lot of men, like we had an amazing bishop in our ward right before we left. Great guy. And I just was thinking, yeah. I'm sure he hates asking those questions. Like,
yeah.
That's so uncomfortable. And for people who are healthy men who have healthy relationships, they don't want to talk to children about this shit.
Yes. Yeah, and there are, because this has been raised to a high level of awareness over the course of what we all did, there are a number of bishops and stake presidents that did decide, no, I'm not asking sexual questions. I'm going to ask parents to come into those interviews. I'm going to make it an uplifting interview for the kid. That's not cool. A downer.
Why not?
In fact, last week, I got a call from somebody that's doing a master's thesis that intersects with the work I've done. And anyway, so she had some questions, and then I asked, so are you an active member of the church? Says, yes, I am. So do you support my work? Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm driving in the car with my dad right now, and he's a bishop, and he completely supports exactly what you were speaking up for. I'm thinking, yes, a victory for our children in that ward. Yeah, but unfortunately, they haven't changed the policies, so there are absolutely places where the 70 tells the stake president, you have to ask the masturbation question. The stake president then puts it on the bishops. You have to ask the masturbation questions. And all the other ones, you got to probe. If somebody is made out, if somebody had sex, you got to probe.
So question for you now is, so I feel like, and obviously, you know, I'm not a member, and so I have a different view, but so in my mind, the work you were doing, it was never meant to be like hateful to the church it was just, hey, this is something that's been tradition. And now we've learned it's not healthy. It's not good. Let's change it. And because of this, because of you putting this forward, you were excommunicated from the church. Is there any other reason that you were given why that they decided to go that route with it?
Yeah, well, in the excommunication letter, and by the way, it is sad, and sometimes I still mourn that I've been cut off from my community, because you're cut off from the community. Mm-hmm. It's just uncomfortable. But that excommunication, you know, when I got the letter, I went up, flew to Salt Lake City, called a press conference. We had like 300 people show up, all this, it got great publicity, great awareness raised. And I opened that thing in public and read my excommunication.
I remember that. I remember watching that on the news. That was very powerful.
Yeah. Oh, cool. Well, that letter I now have framed, posted in a prominent area of my home for that. It's hard to miss when somebody walks in. I've had some folks go over there and look at it and say, geez, what is this? And then you get, it's an opportunity to explain. And these were people that are not members of the church.
Right.
But I'm proud that I wear that excommunication letter with pride. But let's see, what was your question, though?
What was their reasoning?
Says this doesn't have anything to do with your speaking up for children. It has to do with you openly and repeatedly spoke out against the leaders, against the church, something like that. And I looked at it, I spoke out against a policy, not the church. I'm really speaking out for the church. I want to continue being in the church, even though I don't think the stuff is true that you preach about its founding, but I'm not speaking out against the church or its leaders or its doctrine or its theology. I'm speaking out against a policy, this policy right here. So, but anyway, they said, because I was repeat and trying to win people over to my side. Well, absolutely. You know, you're hurting children. What am I supposed to say? You're hurting children and I'm not going to I'm going to keep my mouth shut. No, there's no way I'm going to do that. That's a coward's route. That's an idiot's route. My friend, the guy from Vietnam, the guy that was the police officer that walked in there and said, I'm going to beat you to a pulp if you ever ask that question. No, I'm going to take that attitude when nobody is willing to listen. Talk to my state president multiple times with my bishop multiple times. And they're saying, no, there's no problem, Sam. I'm like, here's 1,000 stories. What about these 1,000 kids? And there are tens of thousands like them. So anyway, speaking against the church. So if what I'm doing is you can't speak up for the children publicly, you got to do it behind closed doors. I'm calling crap on that. The kids are more important than you, church, and your authority and how you look. You just look stupid by doing this. So anyway, that was their rationale.
I kind of assumed, I wasn't positive. Yeah. We watched your excommunication thing on TV. It was a big deal to us because obviously it hit home so much for us. Yeah. And that day we resigned from the church because it broke my heart because I just thought, I guess I always hope because it was my upbringing, because it is my childhood. I always hope like, they're going to change. It's going to get better. Yes. They mean well, these men, they mean well. And I'm not saying that they don't in some circumstances, but there are definitely situations like this, where some of these men, these leaders, these general authorities need to stand up and say, no, this isn't right. This is hurting people and change it. They have the opportunity. They have the knowledge. They have so much at their fingertips in order to change things and make it for the better. And so it just, the fact that they're not just makes me angry sometimes.
Yeah.
It's like they're better than that.
You know, people told me that you need to follow the proper channels in the church, which I did for a period of time. And then allow the church, you'll set the church back by pressing for it. They'll make the church change sooner than they will if somebody has called for the change publicly. And I thought about that for a while, but then realized, well, is the church going to change in 5 years? That's 5 more years of all these kids being harmed. I at least want to raise the alarm loud enough that good parents who will put their children over whatever of the culture of not doing anything until the prophet says something, at least I can raise it to that level where people will make the changes right now to protect their kids. And we had a lot of that happen, but I didn't want to wait around for another generation of children to be damaged.
Well, and what kind of organization takes 5 years to make a freaking policy change?
Well, the Mormon Church.
I mean, they're not going to make a policy change in 5 years. No one's going to make a policy change.
Yeah, that's right.
They're going to make it in a meeting. They're going to make a decision. It's not this big arduous decision-making process that takes years and all this investigation. No, that's not how it works. There's no research done into this. Nobody's taking academic papers and scouring through them and finding meta-analyses and making decisions. That's the problem that I have.
Yeah.
We have information. We have knowledge. Mm-hmm. We have experience. We have loads and loads and loads of stories of people who are consistently and repeatedly harmed by practices that persist.
Yeah.
And a leadership that refuses to address change. But if you don't raise an eyebrow to that, and when it's kids that are getting hurt, and not just hurt, this is very personal for me, and I'm gonna have a hard time not like freaking bawling my eyes out here, because I sit across from people much like a bishop does, and I hear these stories, and it affects my life. It affects my day-to-day. It affects my children, because it's so horrendous what these people go through. And it's not just, sexual abuse in the traditional sense where somebody's touching somebody else. Sexual abuse is questions of a sexual nature in an unfamiliar, unsafe environment. And it's abuse. And it persists.
Absolutely.
And nobody wants to change anything. And nobody wants to ask these questions. And the reason why nobody wants to ask questions like you're asking is because they're afraid. And you're not. And I think you're a fucking badass, man. There's my one F-bomb. Dude. It's amazing
what
you've
done. But they're afraid because look what happened to you. Yeah. You spoke up. You spoke your truth. Yeah. You came out and said, here's what I want to change. You were very vocal about it. And they kick you out. So what kind of message does that send now? So now the message is don't speak against the church or you're
exactly.
And in a place like where we live in Utah, where everyone is Mormon, when you get kicked out like that, when you're excommunicated, people are scared of you now.
Yeah, you're in exile.
People avoid you. People treat you differently. I've watched it. I've heard it. I've seen it. It's just like, and so what they're holding over your head of don't speak out against the church, it's traumatizing. It's detrimental to a lot of people. So they won't do it.
The consequence is you get your entire social connection network ripped away from you without your permission. And that's what happened to you.
And it's hard. It's like even those of us like myself who chose to leave, no one forced me. No one did anything. I chose it. But it still doesn't make it easier when all of your family, many friends, your neighbors, your community is a part of it. And now you are on the outside.
Right.
You are different.
Yeah. Well, and this is not a situation that's unique to the LDS Mormon church either, is it? This is the sexual oppression of children is a systematic problem that exists in many different organizations and faith
practices.
And it's highly, highly publicized. Mm-hmm. And yet change remains out of reach.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of these organizations, when they're religious in nature, are protected because of, we have this Bill of Rights thing, which is really great. But We can't change religious organizations. They're allowed to have their beliefs, and their policies and practices remain out of reach from governmental policy. So the only change that's ever going to happen has to be grassroots. It has to come from within. And so that's why I think what you did, recruiting an army of people to speak out against these policies is the only way that change is going to be created. We're not going to affect change without a large group of people asking for it. And so I don't think that our podcast has a wide enough reach to get people to kind of jump on board. But those of you who do listen, you love Bethany and I, you listen to us every week. For me personally, listeners, this is not a small thing. this is a big deal. This is something that is affecting your children. This is something that will affect them for their entire lifespan. And it is important for you to educate yourselves. It is vital for your children's future that you become involved. Go to protectldschildren.org. Read some of these stories and understand that you and your children are being exposed to this level of abuse by an organization that allows it. And that doesn't mean the LDS Church is bad, by no means. However, we have to call into question practices and policies that are harmful in large-scale organizations. That is our responsibility as human beings. And I would encourage all of you guys out there listening, members, non-members, especially those of you who don't, like, we have a huge following of people who are out of state and have no idea even what the LDS Church is, yeah, just because of the connections that I have outside of state. Go check it out. Become educated in this.
But I was going to say,
just what's going on in your neighborhood?
Aware. Yeah, being aware
is
a big
deal. It's similar. It's not just LDS community unique to have this type of oppression at all. This is a normal practice amongst men oppressing smaller people. Mm-hmm. And this grooming, you said the word grooming earlier, it is so prevalent in our society that we just turn a blind eye to it because we're unaware. So be aware, because your kids need you to be aware.
Or you think, well, this, I went through that situation, so it's, and I'm fine. So where the truth is, it's like, it is going to affect everyone differently. And whether it affects your children or maybe your grandchildren, it will hurt someone. So yes, if you can stop that hurt at some point anywhere.
You said I'm fine, but hold on. I have to pause. Are you?
No, I'm saying a lot of people are like, well, this happened to me and I'm fine. But are you fine?
Really?
Probably not.
Well, what was the first 10 years of your marriage like? What was the first 10 years? Not you personally, but like, what's your relationship with sex like as a person? What the narratives and beliefs that you have about sexual contact, where did you learn those? Did you learn them from mom and dad? Did you learn them from books? Did you learn them from actual practices that we know work? Or did you learn them from somebody who told you something once upon a time? Or do you not have any?
Totally.
Right? Because and I'm not trying to be like this elitist guy, but like, I work with couples all the time, and sexual dysfunction in couples, especially in Utah County, is freaking astronomical.
Mm-hmm.
It's insane.
Well, I was going to say another thing is too, sometimes even when you think you're fine, right? Like work through stuff, which I've worked through a lot of stuff. Yeah. It was fascinating to me because I'm 41 years old and that situation happened when I was 18, right? Well, I'm at an event for my daughter and I see that man.
Oh.
And I hadn't seen him since I was 18 years old. He didn't see me. I saw him. And I had a full-blown panic attack where I thought I was over it. I thought, I've moved on. I'm good. I'm doing awesome. And my husband was sitting there and he was like, what is going on? And so I told him. And it's like, those are the things where you're like, wow, this is a big deal. People need to take it more seriously. It's a big deal.
True. And so I'm just super appreciative of you, Sam. And I'm really glad you came on and you continue to like spread the love and share the message and speak out even against vehement opposition, man. You're just you're a badass, dude. And you keep going and you keep doing it. And I was on your website today, just looking at some of the new content you got on there. It's just awesome. So Before we wrap up, how can people, if people want to reach out to you or get a hold of you or support the Protect LDS Children organization, how can they do that?
Well, they can visit protectldschildren.org and become familiar with it. You read a few of those stories, you realize the dangers of this practice.
Oh, yeah.
Just the raising the awareness is huge. Step up and protect your own kids. Look what's happening in your own community, whether you're a member of the Mormon church or member of any church or any organization. You know, there are problems all over the place that we need to be protecting our children from. I also have another site called protecteverychild.com. So 2018 was basically protecting LDS children. 2019, we did a major campaign of Climb a Mountain, Post a Banner to highlight protecting every child. And then we held a march where 3,200 people came in 2019 too, which was the March Against Child Abuse, highlighting it everywhere, raising awareness about this everywhere. So visit the site. If you want to make a donation, you can do that on either one of those sites. My biggest call out would be look for ways to protect your own children.
I love that.
I love it.
Thank you so much. I said, you've changed our lives and I'm sure many others. So we really appreciate it, Sam.
Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you. What a delightful thing to get to know two more wonderful people, especially people that are working to protect children too, healing.
You know it, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sam.